And just like that, we're on. Good morning. I'm Gareth Cliff. This is The Burning Platform on the podcast party. And if you haven't subscribed, you need to do that ASAP. While we're talking about housekeeping, let me just get this into your head. First thing, make sure it's foremost in your mind, because I think this might be something that you want to come along to. We haven't done an event for a little while, but we did 8 episodes, you may remember, of Democracy Unplugged with an audience. And different panels and different hosts at the beginning of the year, just prior to the election. Well, there's good news, because we are relaunching Democracy Unplugged. It starts again next Wednesday. That's the 16th of October at 5:30 p.m. Make a note in your diary now. We've got the founder co-host of Burning Platform, Justice Malala, and no less than Justice Malala, as the host of a panel of prominent political leaders who will discuss day 100 of the GNU, which has already passed us by, but we have enough context now to be able to give them some kind of report card. And I think Justice will be scathing of those who have not delivered. And I doubt very much he's going to be over the top praising them if they did a good job, because that's pretty much why they should be there in the first place. But we'll find out. And of course, Justice doesn't hold back. How are we doing in South Africa is the theme. There are a few places left, so if you want to join our exclusive audience, you can email contact@podcastparty.co.za. That's contact@podcastparty.co.za. Tickets will be allocated on a first come, first served basis, and the event is free. But going forward, we're going to have to make more tickets available for purchase so that you can secure your place. And also because we've realized, like a lot of people have, that if you make people pay for something, they pitch because it's got value, right? As opposed to just like, it's a free ticket. I don't feel like going tonight or whatever. So you can email us at contact@podcastparty.co.za now to be the first in line for this special Democracy Unplugged featuring none other than Justice Malala. You get to meet him, you get to ask questions, you get to interact. And I know we've got a very lively comment section, but it would be nice to meet some of you as well. So come along. Here is, as always, my co-host on a Thursday morning, and she's looking particularly lovely this morning because Pumi just does this thing where she has like the world's most interesting hair every other week. So, here she is today.
Oh, my friends.
Looking like Naomi Campbell did at her hottest, I must say.
It is, and don't be afraid, it is I, even though I'm in white. It's the, it is me. I'm bringing it all. Yeah.
This is a very rare thing. Are you getting remarried, Pums? What's the wife?
I'm in costume. I'm on my way to an event that actually the theme is all white. All white. So I'm actually everything.
Not a Diddy party, is it? That would be terrible.
Woo. I don't know. I don't know if I qualify for P. Diddy parties. Don't know if I qualify. But it is I am here bringing the same dark mood, I think. But wow. I'm extremely excited about today's guest because...
Yeah, I am too. Well, let me give him a proper intro here because I think he's deserving of it. I've got to admit, though, that I'm very happy I'm not in the studio with you guys this morning because I'd be making you sick. You can hear it in my voice. I was in bed last night at 9 o'clock like an old man with med lemon and hoping to get rid of this. I think I should be okay shortly. So let's get into it. All right. So we've got a lot to talk about this morning. And I want to start off by introducing our guest to you. He won't be a stranger to anybody who listens to The Burning Platform. We haven't had him on for a very long time. But he is known to many people for his brilliant podcast, which is called State of the Nation. And he does exactly that. We're going to be joined by the guy who makes it his business to help us understand and analyze what's going on in the political realm. And he is none other than Mike Sham. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Gareth. Nice to be on. First time.
Thank you. It's your first time, because I'm sure you've been on my show before.
No.
Really?
No. I haven't. But I've got to say, for me, you were talking about going to an all-white party. I'm so old that I remember when all-white parties were different parties. Nothing like setting the tone.
I love it. Well, he's not going to be quiet and demure this morning, is he, Mike?
But this is why we have you on, Wise Elder.
Absolutely. So let's get straight into it, because I think you've been quite vocal about this whole situation that's unfolded in Tshwane. Apparently, we have a new mayor now. Sia is trying to line her up for an interview with us next week. But this is our capital city. I get very cut up and angry about the fact that as a paying resident, I get the least amount of attention from these politicians. They give the most to themselves. Then they seem to deal it out according to who votes for them. And I think a lot of people in this country are just tired of seeing wasteful expenditure, which happens everywhere and under every government, some more than others, obviously. It's not proportionally fair to say that they're all the same. But these politicians actually don't give a damn about us. They're mostly interested in securing their own position. And I think all of us are really, really annoyed with this. So tell us what your feeling is, whether you're a resident of Tshwane, of Ekurhuleni, of Johannesburg, Cape Town, wherever in the country, because it seems to be a pattern which has been followed in any of these coalition capitals.
Yeah, Gareth, you know, I have covered it quite extensively. And I think the way to look at it is that it's just a continuation of the same political fight. What's going on in Tshwane has got absolutely nothing to do with service delivery. It has got nothing to do with the performance of the previous mayor or the future mayor or anything else. It has only to do with the national political picture. And I recently did an analysis that actually sort of was ahead of the curve. And that is that I said, what is playing out in Tshwane, quite simply, is a battle for the soul of the ANC between Cyril Ramaphosa on the one hand, and call them the pro-government of national unity faction, and Panyaza Lesufi, that clearly wants to be the next leader of the ANC, has spotted the gap in collapsing the GNU. And then he comes out as the strong man. He comes out as the leader in the, you know, in the face of Cyril, who's never really been a leader. He's always been one of those guys, you know, more sort of process chairman of the board kind of guy. And Paul Mashatile, who looks dead from the ankles up. So, you know, along comes Panyaza Lesufi. He looks vibrant, prepared to fight, prepared to stick it to the man. And it helps that, you know, what the man looks like. So it's purely politics at play. And this has been a power move. We saw at the last minute Fikile Mbalula try to rescue the situation, but he's perhaps dead from the skull down. But, you know, the thing is, not the brightest oak in the world, and couldn't stop this power play. And now we've got a puppet mayor in Tshwane.
But I did also see the show where you gave Silius quite a hard time.
I did. I did give him a hard time, and I gave him a hard time because I think that there's you know, any fight, you're in a fight. And the hardest part, you know, I'm Lebanese and from the south of Joburg. I know what a fight looks like, right? And when that fight has started, it's started. There's no negotiating once the fight has started.
And has a life of its own.
It has a life of its own. And while I took a hard line on Silius Brinkhu, I like, and I think he's got he's an important voice in South Africa, is that I think that you've got to see it in the light of he said exactly the wrong thing, saying that he's got to be kept on as mayor to keep the EFF out of the city of Tshwane management. And I said to him, whoa, stop there, because it's got nothing to do with the EFF. They just happen to be winning while, you know, they're the third dog that runs away with the bone while the two are fighting. And you can't blame them for being them. You know, that's what they do. The real people that have let you down, for starters, is his own party, where they've shown no leadership. You know, it's that old Karen thing of writing a strongly worded letter. You've got to do a little bit more than that, you know? So on the one hand, he's been thoroughly, thoroughly let down by his leadership. And I did a piece on that as well. Of course, the ANC, because you really got to go to your partner. We're business partners and you're doing something that cuts me out. I'm going to go to you and say, what the hell? What are you doing? And I'm going to make it quite public. I'm not going to sit back and say, oh, well, you know, we're a little bit unclear or this or that or the other. No, go down there and force everybody's hand. Show leadership. Instead, trying to get away with this blaming the EFF doomsday coalition. It's nonsense. So I thought that his answer, which is kind of a typical DA process answer, if I could put it that way, needed interrogating. Because don't blame the EFF, blame your own party, blame your coalition party partner.
Speaking of blaming your coalition partner, I mean, I am old enough to remember when African leaders used to be afraid to go to the UN because they'd go to the UN and they'd leave yes. their country and there'd be a coup.
Yes.
And basically, people laughed at me. I said, that's Lusufi did. Mm. Exact same thing, did, right? Yeah. Waited for Cyril to be out yeah. of the country because the week before, when they were supposed to have this vote of no confidence, when they were supposed to push it through, they did not.
Yeah.
And so Cyril felt comfortable, felt safe. He left the country. He went to the UN General Assembly and boom.
It's a step worse than that. Lusufi left the country the week before when they had the vote of no confidence.
Mm.
So, you know, it's plausible deniability. You leave the country. So, well, I wasn't around. It wasn't me. And then he goes on a cringeworthy interview to say he's not interested in power, which is the African, South African way of saying I'm interested in power, right? And, you know.
I want it badly.
But,
so how seriously do we take Panyaza Lusufi? Because he has, I mean, he's been a sort of looming presence in Gauteng for a while. He didn't seem to have terribly much effect on voter turnout or on actual votes during the last election, despite the fact that he said he was some kind of, massively popular figure. Does he actually have, A, the support that he claims to have? B, is he a serious contender here? C, can Cyril do anything about it? And we know that Cyril's back is about as bent as it's possible for anyone's to be, so he's unlikely to suddenly discover courage in his late 60s. And D, and probably the most important part of this, where is his support coming from? Like, is Panyaza being guided by a dark kind of cohort of people inside the ANC who are shadowy that we know nothing about, or are his supporters obvious and plain to see?
It's a bit more simple than that, I think, Gareth, and that is that I don't think that there's I don't think this one's too hard to untangle, and that is that there's this feeling that gets fostered amongst the black political class that you must never deal with the DA, and that was always going to be a controversial thing to enter into a coalition with the DA, which Cyril did. So it left the ANC within the ANC, to what extent the ANC still have a constituency, that you could almost be the voice that represents, call it the Africanist faction of the ANC. Hey, read every watch every speech, listen to Sali Mapaila. You know what I mean? It's there, it's in the open. The point is that this GNU, if you had to have an internal referendum in amongst ANC members, I don't know if the GNU would get more than 30% within the membership. So what Panyaza Lusufi is doing is he's understanding that this is the gap. He's always been an ambulance chaser, so it's fine. You know, it sort of fits the mold. And nobody else is showing any leadership. You know, the hallmark of Cyril has always been to kill off any signs of leadership, including his own. So now you've got a guy that is out there showing leadership. And yeah, humans are humans. This cuts across culture, etc. We all like leaders. We like to be told what to do. That's just the human condition. Now you've got a president that cuts and runs at everything, and here's a guy who's looking like a leader. It's going to work. It is going to work. It's going to work, and he knows that he's got ready allies in Malema, and he's got ready allies in maybe Zuma, but that would be a dance with death. But the point is that it's going to work. I got the feeling that it's going to take some kind of rear guard action to not have him elected as the next ANC leader.
Mm, wow, that is mind blowing.
But
I didn't
mind.
Hear it said like that.
Yeah. Before we go on to the next point, is that don't be mistaken. He doesn't need a constituency. Cyril came in without any constituency. Right?
Well, he had a money constituency.
No, but he didn't. I'm saying he didn't bring people along with him. You know, so I'm saying the idea, Zuma came in with a certain constituency. He was, all the people that were thieves were rallying behind Zuma. That's fine. He had a constituency. You know, but the point is that he doesn't need a constituency. The constituency will grow. It's there. We know what it is already. And let's be kind and call it the very Africanist constituency.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it is, for me, mind-blowing to hear it said in that way, because it also kind of illuminates a whole lot of other things that we have been seeing play out, but kind of haven't been paying attention to. But I do think that one of the things, and you said quite rightly, that the EFF becomes the third dog that runs away with the bone. Mm. And here now in Tshwane, for the first time, they've got portfolios. Mm. You know, they're at the table, have portfolios. We saw what happened with them in Johannesburg. We saw what happened with them in Ekurhuleni. What is your view of, and you said also that the new mayor is a puppet mayor, right? So what is your view? I know nothing about her. About what this new coalition or organization in the council at City of Tshwane can achieve, and can it last?
It can last, because you're almost going to have a coalition of people that are, you know, a bit like we're seeing in the city of Joburg and Ekurhuleni, where the coalition has to stay together, because otherwise too many people have got dirt on too many of the others. The thing about the city of Tshwane is that service delivery is going to be decimated. It's going to be decimated. They're going to run deficits like crazy. Bear in mind that this fight really started when Celia Brink took a hard line against workers' salaries, which the city's bankrupt, like all the other metros in Gauteng. So when he took a hard line on workers' salaries and they went on strike, and he said, well, strike. And the city survived and they came back under his terms. Those fights, you know, in the long run, you're not going to win, because, you know, in South Africa, our workers are used to getting paid and used to getting above inflation increases, whether they do the job or not. The next thing he did is he got the last sort of icing on the cake was when he brought in a few regulations where they improved the standards on, for example, rubbish trucks had to be less than 9 years old. They had to be tracked with satellite trackers to prove that they've done what they've said they've done. And that kind of thing immediately sealed his fate, because, you know, we've got business interests now in these municipalities and metros where people don't want anybody watching what they're doing. The water tankers want the water not to work. They don't want somebody coming in and fixing it up. So we've got a sort of a criminal syndicate that runs in our cities and municipalities. And don't ask me, ask the Auditor General's there for the public to see. And there is absolutely no chance that Tshwane is going to avoid this. And bear in mind that the big cover that you have, the big veil that you sit under, is the veil of working for the poor. So what happens when the services start collapsing in the rate-paying areas, but the services are never delivered in the poor areas? Yeah. And, you know, it's very easy to say, oh, but, you know, it was even worse. Well, who knows? So it's going to be exactly the same as what happens.
I think it's like what you said at the very beginning of this. Tshwane is just a piece on the chessboard which needs to be moved at the moment. It's actually got very little to do with who runs the city, any of the actual work being done. This is pure power politics, and the loser is going to be the citizen.
But what do you think this means going into the local general election, which is the next cycle that we're going into? What does this mean for the GNU coalition, and what does it mean for people like Mashaba's Action SA?
Look, I think that Mashaba's Action SA has sealed their fate. Right? And I've spoken to them many, many times, and, you know, they did hold a lot of promise. But I think that they're now neither one nor the other. Right? Initially, they came across, and the dog whistle was that they were the DA but included blacks. That was the dog whistle, right? Then now their dog whistle is what? They are the DA that is actually the ANC. What is it? Well, basically, where are they going to get?
I don't know that Herman Mashaba had any black support before this. He certainly had a lot of white people's support, and he's made a very clear statement about how he feels about that.
Yeah.
So he's betting on a horse that ain't going to run.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, Gareth. I think that they disappeared in the next local government election. You know, they're riven with it's a revenge. It's now just become a revenge party. But anyway, you know, the thing about it is that, yeah, you've got a similar thing brewing with, say, the EFF and MK. Why buy the copy if you can get the original at the same price, right? So if you look at the EFF MK, if you want to vote for crazy, why vote for Julius when you can vote for Jacob, right? Crazier, there's the original crazy. So, you know, if you want to blow the place up, vote for the guy who blew the place up. If you want to vote for the ANC, vote for the ANC. If you want to vote for the DA, vote for the DA. But Action SA is going to get squeezed out on the rails here quite badly.
I think watching the absolute meltdown that Herman Mashaba has had over the past couple of... I mean, for after the big election, Herman kind of fell off, right? He was quiet on social media. We didn't hear a lot from him. He kind of... As he'd said, he doesn't want to go to parliament. He wants to be strategically leading the party. Great for Herman. But when this Tshwane thing came about, I have been watching a man absolutely unhinged. I mean, I think he said to you, do you remember this, Gareth, where he was almost in tears about how he will never work with the ANC? Watching the past 3 weeks of Herman's unhinged online.
I'll give you credit. I have to do this far too often on the show for my liking, but you've always been suspicious of his motives. And you said you right from the start asked the toughest questions and gave him no leeway. And maybe you saw something that the rest of us didn't early on, because you did pick up on this stuff. I think the less said about ASA from here on in, the better, because it's not a valuable part of the discussion anymore. So, Mike, I do want to move on, because even though Tshwane is...
We can't move on from Tshwane, because Tshwane is going to be, I think Tshwane is going to be a harbinger of very bad things coming up in the next 2 years for the GNU. But I'm also wondering what prospects then, you said vote for the original crazy, as they are making strides now, MK has, in a place like Tshwane, as you rightly said, there is definitely a criminal element working in all the municipalities, and we know where they seem to be congealing those criminals. What do you think of MK's prospects in...
I don't think their prospects are very good. Honestly, I don't think that they will repeat their performance of the last election. Only because, they're proving themselves to be disorganized. This is really, the party is a Zuma project, or it's certainly been hijacked to be a Zuma project. And we recall from his presidency that he doesn't like structures. He wants to be in control. And the easiest way to be in control, go and look at any horror movie, any one of those sort of movies, what you do is you keep people unstable. Never sure who's going to get fired next. You get rid of people that are rising stars. This is going to be, just remember how often Jacob Zuma used to change his cabinet, right? That was kind of a power play, because what it does is if you see that your mate has just been axed, then maybe you'll be a little less inclined to be independent the next time. Mm. So that works fine when you've got the power. He doesn't. He's got limited power, and they're going through a good patch at the moment, but it's early days. But in the long term, much like we've seen with some of these other parties that have come along, and Action SA is an example of that. One leader doesn't want to have an elective conference, et cetera, et cetera. You're at the whims of that leader and what they decide to do. I mean, Herman, I like him. I know him well. One man boogie, woke up one day, going to start a party. It's going to, get South Africa working, etc. Woke up the next day, decided, no, I'm going to go back with the guys who've broken it in the first place. The point is that MK have got a bad dose of that, and eventually it runs out of runway. Right, and that is this one man, you know, dictatorship that you've got in Action SA, MK, EFF, UDM, YEL. You've got a list of them.
Gareth, now you can move on.
Yeah, I feel like I've forced Tshwane to the front of every conversation just because I live here and the people who
it's
live in
the capital city.
I know, I agree for all those reasons, but I do want to talk a little bit about something broader, and it's something which you addressed in your I think it was your latest show or your second to last, is the idea that South Africa, we're spending ourselves into oblivion here. I mean, I know it's a huge problem in America. Inflation is through the roof there because Joe Biden and Kamala Harris just signed off over the last 3 years, billions and billions and billions of dollars of government spending. They printed money. America is going to be dealing with this for a long time. They've got an unbelievable deficit, but at least America's good for it, right? On paper. They're the world's biggest economy still, on paper. We are not, and we can ill afford to ruin. Well, we can ill afford to ruin the lives of our citizens who are already, in so many ways, on the breadline, and some of them dipping into poverty, some of them living in perpetual poverty. We know that this is a huge problem. How are our spending habits lining up with regard to all of these conversations about politics? Because we focus on people like Panyaza Lesufi and like John Steenhuisen and like Jacob Zuma and Cyril and Celia Brink. But actually, what we should be looking at is the balance sheet.
And Panyaza is a big spender.
Yeah.
Big time.
Well, yeah, you know, ultimately, it's always going to end with the money. That's where we never have to worry too much about populists, because ultimately, somebody's going to call up your debt and you're going to have to dance to their tune, right? That's just the way of the world. And we can give you 100 examples of that. But sure, think about it this way. South Africa has to pay approximately $1 billion a day in interest, a billion rand a day in interest. Okay, that's not even paying back the debt. That's just paying the interest on the debt. We have to pay 340 billion rand every year in interest payments. A day. Now, that's just like buying everything on budget on your credit card. And now your entire salary is going to go to pay the interest, not even pay back the money that you owe on your credit card.
Right.
It can't work. There seems to be absolutely no economic plan. There's nothing. And I mean, you know, this could be the undoing of the government of national unity, is that, what are you going to do? You're going to go and run the same bad ANC economic policies, but just do them better? How's that going to help our economy? You know, we need to have a whole economic rethink. And that's only going to come, before the election, I was sort of saying, maybe it's time for us to do the dice with the devil. You know, let's the ANC, EFF, MK run the country. Let the rand go to 300 to the dollar. Let's have hyperinflation. And then we'll stop toying with these failed economic policies, which have never worked anywhere. You know, and then everybody says, yeah, but China. Well, China, very, very different model, very different model. You've got state, a strong state, but they shoot you if you're corrupt. It's that simple. Right. So, you know, and it's a very different environment, very different society. So the point is that we are playing a very dangerous game that is impossible for us to win right now. We would need about 5% growth to stand still. And what are we at, about 2% growth?
So if the clock is ticking, like what sort of a timeline do we have until we are officially broke?
Well, you know, we're going to get some leeway and some more leeway, which we're busy getting. And, you know, for example, let's go down to local government level, just because it's easier. The city of Johannesburg has got a budget, it collects rates of 80 billion rand a year, 80. This year, they had to get a loan from a French company that's ostensibly for capital projects, in other words, to build infrastructure, 2.5 billion rand. That's why Herman Mashaba voted with him. So that the city could get 2.5 billion rand of a loan that was set out for capital loan to pay current expenses. That's absolutely crazy. That's like you getting another home loan and you're going to spend it on partying or clothing or petrol, you know? And otherwise, the city would have been bankrupt. So we're starting to see that kind of irresponsible behavior. And that's why there's every attempt to keep responsible politics away and talk more about ideological stuff. Because ultimately, you got it, you know, somebody's going to have to pay this money back.
And, you know, talking about our economic policies, with not only inequality out the roof, as we've seen over the past couple of years, our unemployment and no plans towards changing that situation is one of the biggest nooses around our necks.
It is.
Right? It is. Because part of the reason why the cities, the municipalities are struggling to collect what they should be collecting is because half the people are unemployed. So,
yes and no. There's many people that are employed that won't pay rates. And why would you? You'd have to be stupid to pay rates. Those of us that pay rates are just being stupid. Because there's no recourse, you know. It's a bit like
Gareth's fight with him and Mashaba.
It's a bit like the old e-toll argument, right? Why would you want to be the one guy with a tag when nothing's going to happen to you if you don't have a tag? Mm. So we got to the same point with rates, electricity, etc. Why would I be the one guy who pays when there's 10 guys that aren't paying? So soon enough, even though I can afford to pay, I'm not going to pay. And then what happens? Is that, you know, if the community is united in not paying, the government then backs the community because there's more votes there. So law enforcement is becoming more and more difficult. It's kind of like, you know, everything goes down to the same thing. State capture was the same. If one person steals money, you can put them in jail. But if everybody's stealing money, you have a commission of inquiry, right? And then nobody pays the price. So this is kind of where we are. And the reason that there's anti-GNU feeling is because there is this sort of feeling that, whoa, hang on a second, yeah, we could be held to account. And if that happens, this could be devastating.
I think about the e-toll example often, and I think about what happened to the ANC in the last election after they went full guns blazing for NHI. And I keep thinking about the enormous black middle class in this country who are struggling like anyone in the middle class to retain their position, to be able to put their kids through school, to be able to buy the groceries, to put petrol in the car, all of that stuff. These are people who are dealing on the daily with very practical problems. They're not as interested in whether Panyaza believes in X, Y, or Z, or whether Celia Brink wants to stand against Herman Mashaba somewhere. They don't actually give a shit about that. And I think it's completely hypocritical and self-righteous of a bunch of politicians who only live off other people's income to go after the people who are paying their rates and taxes and make them the villains in a story, which is why I had that spat. It wasn't a spat that I chose to have. Herman Mashaba is obviously interested in having one himself. I mean, I haven't been back to read any comments, and I won't. But why should hardworking black and white South Africans, which is why I mentioned the black middle class, because it's not just white taxpaying South Africans. It's the people who've always shouldered the burden, who are already paying a huge amount of income tax, company tax, all kinds of other taxes on duties, on importing things, on electricity, on any number of services that they have to get in private that they can't get from the public because they're shit. And these people are somehow villainized. These are the people who, people like Herman Mashaba and the ANC say, those are the bad guys, the ones who are paying. Now, either you can have my money or you can have my guilt, but you can't have both. Mm. And I'm all out of guilt. So you've got to be a little more grateful for the money that ordinary taxpaying South Africans are handing over to these corrupt, inefficient parasites who are our politicians. And I think we're getting to a point very quickly where ordinary South Africans are going to here and no further. We're going to find ways of sending our money overseas. We're going to find ways of paying less tax. We're going to do things like tax revolts on a small level. And I think it's already happening.
Yeah, but it's got to be, you raised, and I think there's two issues there. One is that I think the baton has to be handed over to the black middle class that are silent. You know, I think at one of the most, you remember back in the heyday of Donald Trump, how good he was at insults. And some of them stuck and literally ended political careers because they were good insults. you know, yep. when the Lion Ted and, you know, Crooked Hillary, and suddenly yep. people viewed those people differently. Well, one of the best insults that was ever done in South Africa was when Jacob Zuma called the black middle class clever blacks. And suddenly yep. the black middle class yep. withdrew from the conversation completely. Now you've got black captains of industry saying nothing, right?
Yeah.
And Craven. Watching the country go down the toilet, absolutely silent. The white middle class, now let's, once again, I've got proof of this. If you go back to the City of Tshwane thing, I had Michael Beaumont from your favorite party, Gareth, on the show. And, you know, he put out the dog whistle saying, well, this was when I thought the idea of this was ridiculous. This was still in those golden days. It was about 3 weeks ago. But he said, well, you know, I said, but I thought the City of Tshwane was doing well, and you got the deputy mayor. And he said the thing, and maybe he caught me on the wrong day. He said, well, it depends on which side of the tracks you live. Obviously, in South Africa, we understand that dog whistle. That dog whistle is that if you live in the white areas, you're okay. And if you live in the other areas, you're not okay. Well, that assumes that the white areas are still white. And nobody wants to say anything about it. Now, I don't know how many suburbs out there are white anymore. You know, if you're going to go to those traditionally white suburbs, probably going to be 50-50 at
anybody best. who's listening, just count on your own street. And I very much doubt that unless you're living in Orania, you're going to find yourself only surrounded by people of the same skin color as you. Right. So I think, and bear in mind also that, you know, the white Indian and colored population of this country is a tiny little sprinkling on the top, really. Right. So, you know, it's not worth people constantly churning up this old story. And the fact is, if there is still a story like that, if it is still white areas, and if it is still only the whites who are paying the taxes, which is nonsense, then what the hell have the ANC been doing for the last 30 years? Because then that's on them.
Yeah. But the point is that pothole that's not being fixed in Parkhurst, which is probably 60-40 black to white, on the basis that there's still a significant number of white people in there. Well, what are you saying to the black residents of that suburb? That you don't deserve a decent road, or your family living in some other area has got a worse road than you? You know, but the point is that a significant black middle class has to get vociferous, because they're going to be the people that suffer the most. They're the ones with the most to lose, but yet they are doing nothing about it, saying very, very little about it, you know, just sort of looking the other way, whistling, hand in pocket, letting this all play out. And I've got a feeling that we've got an issue in South Africa that needs to be dealt with. And my best sort of thing that I came up with to sort of give this a bit of a vision is that I'm sure this transcends. Now, look, I'm not the youngest, okay, I'm sitting in this panel, but I call it the 40-year-old man at the disco. Now, I'm sure everybody has a version.
Disco. Right.
That's it. Right? Now, at the club, right? Let's go to the club. Is that okay? Right. Yeah. We've all been there. You're a young guy. You're a young guy or girl. You're out at a party spot that's aimed at these young, good-looking people. And there's some dude that shouldn't be there. He should be at home with his wife and kids. Right? But instead, he's there. He's wearing the clothes that used to be in fashion 20 years before. Correct me when I'm wrong, Pumi.
Right,
he's wearing his tight white pants, right, whatever it is. And he's trying to act like he's 25, and he's the only one who's buying his act, right? Mm. You know, he's trying to attract these young girls on this basis that I'm actually like you, but he's nothing like you. You know, he's starting to yawn at 10:30. We've all seen it. Now, what's going through that guy's mind? That guy's mind is, look, I can still do it. If you just look past, if you just don't believe your eyes, you'd fall for it. The political version of this is that we've got these pseudo-revolutionaries in South Africa.
The
guys that feel that we just didn't have the civil war we should have had. And, you know, the ANC won't say that they're speaking for the middle class. They say, no, they're the revolutionary party and the second National Democratic Revolution and this bullshit. Instead of running a country the way a country is meant to be run, and call them out on it. You know, the middle class, their peers that aren't in government, should be calling them out on it, but they won't. They're too scared. So we've got to grow a pair in South Africa, in the South African middle class. And we understand how easy it is. It's very, very easy to write off anything that comes out of a white mouth or an Indian mouth. It's got to come out of the black middle class. They've got children in this country. In fact, their children are leaving the country. It's an interesting thing.
But of course.
But which countries are they going to?
Australia.
Yeah, England. Australia, England. Are any of them going to Venezuela? Or any of them going to China? You know, any of them going to Russia? So why are you supporting?
Well, Cyril's son did go to China, but that's for other reasons.
Yeah.
Mike, you know, this is your analogy is amazing. It does sound like some people's weekend plans, yeah. As they say.
Sorry, guys, just go to the club. I know that's fine.
But, you know, definitely something that we have seen a ramp up of in the past couple of years is a nostalgia for a revolution that could have, should have, must have been. Yeah. You see, and you kind of saw it ramped up a lot by the EFF and all the dog whistles, as we say, right? All the dog whistles of the other side of the tracks, of who's who, the black and the white, and the digs at stuff like stronger together campaigns, all of that. We've definitely seen, even in our comment section, you see a lot of the black-white kind of because you're white, because you're black, stuff, tension. And you speak to a lot of politicians, political party leaders. Do you think there's anybody out there who sits on that spectrum where they are saying there's an opportunity to bring South Africans, to rally South Africans around a particular force that is for all of us? Is there anybody like that out there?
No, but I think you've got to be careful, Pumi. You've got to be careful that we don't get stuck on the savior idea.
Mm-hmm.
That there's one person out there that will come along.
No, right? Not one person, but anyone in the spectrum.
Not the way it's structured at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Not the way it's structured at the moment. And that cuts across parties.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I probably did my most scathing thing last week where I really think that the DA, for example, there's a John Steenhuisen problem. Poor leadership. No charisma. No vision. What is his vision? Right? You can pick apart the way that party is being run. So if one's saying, oh, that's the savior, really? What is their plan? To write strongly worded letters? I don't think that's going to improve South Africa necessarily. You've got to be a little bit more visionary than that. Right? You've got to understand that you can't grow, given South Africa's situation, with your current strategy of best man for the job that always happens to be a white man. Yeah, it's not a very, very good sales structure. No, you know, so we've got a problem even in the parties where one could say, yes, they do govern better. They have governed better where they've governed where they've had a majority. The point is that none of this is going to change until people understand that the citizens are holding them to account. Now, the real concern that we should be having in South Africa is that, yeah, we always thought that we'd never get to the point where the ANC, firstly, it was very difficult to believe that they would eventually end up at 40%. I think it reached a little bit earlier than this. But where they would on purpose want the country's youth to be poorly educated and poor. Understand, this is deliberate. It's deliberate because it keeps people dependent on the state, right? You keep them ill-informed. You give them bad education. You keep a state broadcaster so that they only get one side of the story, and you make them dependent on the state for their very well-being. And it's part of a well-worn strategy. It happens in many, many countries, and now South Africa is there. And we need to understand that the last thing that the ANC wants is a well-educated population, because they would then lose votes. Every time they go through this, they'll lose votes. That's why if you look at what happens, you know, the difference between for example, somebody voting for the EFF and then stopping to vote for the EFF is the day they start paying taxes. Then they start saying, oh, shit, actually, hang on a second. We had this all wrong. We need that education to happen, and we need civil society and society as a whole to start becoming a little bit more animated. We need to speak out about these things that we just sort of laugh about. It's not so funny. It's very serious, yeah, and it's going to look a lot worse in 10 years' time if we don't start doing something about it now.
Do you think,
all right.
Do you think that where they sit today in the position of jostling and communicating with the ANC as they say they do, we had Helen Zilla on the show last week, that the DA has an opportunity to steer a government like the GNU is structured into the right path? Do you think they have that opportunity? Helen Zilla says they do.
If they approach this differently with leadership, with charisma, if they started to speak more about what they are in favor of as opposed to what they are against, if they started to understand some of the issues that drive South African behavior, right, then they could steer the GNU, but they're not doing any of that. They're not doing any of that. What is their strategy? The few portfolios that Cyril threw our way, we'll just run them better, and then everybody will see it, and they'll say, oh, silly us. Let's vote for the DA. That's not going to happen. Because if that was going to happen, the rest of the country would have looked at the Western Cape, said, this is so much better. Let's all vote for them because there's the proof, right? So it goes to show that different things are at play in South Africa. And you've got to be sensitive to what is at play. It is, to me, the most frustrating thing to see the answers there, but you just won't read the answer. Right. So I don't think I can steer it in their current form. And all I see them doing is acquiescing at every level. They just go and they just say, yes, sir. They say, oh, we hate this. Okay. We're there, you know. What did they want to get?
Ooh.
They said they were against the NHI. That went through. They said they were against Bella. That went through. They said they want to be part of Gauteng. They didn't. So they've just lost at every turn. So there seems to be no – if surrender is a tactic, they've got it down pat. They're doing really well.
Sure. Do we as South Africans have the political maturity, though, to be part of an uprising that says – how, even as civil society, right, there's so much shit going on. Civil society is so fragmented in many different places. People are trying to plug holes, what I see. Do we have the maturity as the electorate to kind of go, what do we need to do to move together and get our young people involved and get the middle class involved? Wake up, everybody.
I think we do, because we've done it before. The circumstances were different. I lived through the previous successful uprising, which happened in the late 80s into the early 90s, where every South African said, we've had enough of this. Enough. It stops. But then, you know, it was pretty easy to unite about what we had had enough of. We'd had enough of apartheid. Now, what, you know, you've got to say, and this has been the genius of the ANC, is to say that the problem is them. They are the problem. We all know what the dog whistle is, the inequality. Let me tell you about the inequality. The inequality is probably the worst statistic in the world. And I'll tell you why. And that's not to gloss over the inequalities. They're real. Firstly, very few countries get measured on this Gini coefficient, for example, where they measure inequality. Only about less than half of the countries in the world. If you want real equality, go to Chad. Go to Malawi. There's equality. Everybody's poor. Then you've got equality. Now, equality is not such a great thing when you look at it like that. We're going to have inequality in a country that does have an economy, because there's winners and losers. That's just the way of the world. Some people, I wish I could, I don't know, run 100 meters in, 10 seconds. I can't. So not everybody's been born with the same gifts. You're going to have a disparity you're going to have inequality. The idea that there's some place that's equal, you can only be equally poor. You can't be equally rich. It's impossible. No country in the world is equally rich. So we've got to start burying some of these myths. And then we've got to be really careful of one thing. And that is, we've got to be very careful of the influence of big business. And by big business, I'm talking about the brands we know and we love. These guys are in bed with government. So deep. And well, there's a reason why they do it. Because
that's why they love Cyril.
They love them all. Don't worry about it. Because what do you do is that, who can cut a check right now? I know that I can't, and I'm sure Gareth can't, for 500 million rand.
I also can't. Just for the record.
But I don't know. You're so nicely dressed up. I thought maybe. So in other words, what starts happening is that you say that business must be represented. Well, I don't hear them calling people like us to go and sit on those committees. They're going to get the CEO of the big corporates there. So what do the big corporates do? They bail out government. They help them. They make it look really good. So this is what business would like. But what do business get in return? They get a lot of regulation. In fact, in most cases, they get to write the regulation, right? So if you're a bank and you get to write the regulation, you make sure that it's almost impossible for somebody else to start a bank, right? That if you're a cell phone company, you make it impossible for other people to start a cell phone company. So big business, please understand, when they say, oh, we got to talk to business, you're not talking to business. You're talking to mega corporations that are protected by the legislation that they've written or signed off on. So, you know, we need to make them very uncomfortable. Big business has to be very uncomfortable. So they stop this thing of supporting the state.
Well, look, we're in the worst of the situations, right? Where our government is in a league with the unions and with business. And so those three, none of them are holding each other to account. And we, the little people, are the ones that get trampled on. We're the ones that really, really suffer. It's the worst of the situation.
It is
big business and the unions and government all aligned.
And that's why you can go past any shopping district or shopping center and see half the shops open, empty, because that person that had a small clothing business has had to shut down because there's no economy. Mm. And who's open? Well, the big companies that have clothing stores, right? They can keep running because they've almost got the monopoly on business. Mm. So, yeah, South Africa has got a few challenges that we're going to have to deal with, but we need to be quite deliberate about it. And I tell you what, into every vacuum, leadership will emerge. Whether it be the right leadership or the wrong leadership is going to emerge. Mm. So, you know, something's got to happen because we're running out of money.
We have run out of money. I think we have run out of money. That's why everywhere you see Cyril with his begging bowl hand, everywhere you see him, he's asking for money and checks.
Let's talk about our position in the world at the moment, because I think there has been quite a lot of optimism and hope around the fact that South Africa has turned a corner since this election. I mean, it doesn't sound like it if you listen to this morning's Burning Platform. It sounds like we're in exactly the same position we were in before, except that now the politicians have filled us with nonsense and false hope.
Now they've really ganged up against us.
Correct. And now there isn't a friend among them, right?
They are together in the crookface.
You did speak to Wayne Duvenager recently on corruption. And what did you learn from that conversation? Because if there is a civil society, it's people like him at Outer that are leading it.
Sadly, what I learned from him is that corruption is alive and well and living in South Africa, right? That it's just, you know, not getting the airplay that it used to get, because perhaps we don't, you know, we're hoping for a better outcome, but it's become absolutely endemic, as we spoke about earlier, you know, with the metros, with these various mafias which have now sprung up. And, you know, there's bad legislation which allows for those mafias. Must understand where it comes from. That doesn't come in a vacuum. It doesn't come from, you know, like a normal mafia like we know from our television sets. This is legislated mafia. So what you do is you have legislation for example, you know, like procurement processes, that immediately is opening you up to a mafia, because this isn't about the best person for the best job at the best price. That's simple. That's science. Instead, there's this dark hole you've got to go into, and you've got to decide who's the best person for the job, and somebody sitting in a smoke-filled room deciding that this job should go to me rather than Pumi, even though she's the engineer and I'm not.
Yeah.
Right. And then I get this job, and then what do I do? I mean, we're seeing it just down the road over here in Santon Drive, where they've been. I look at it with a bit of interest, where they've been sort of fixing this road, but it's already been about 6 months, and you can see what happens. A contractor comes every second week, does a little bit, then disappears. Does a little bit, then disappears. Right now, what happens is you've got the contract. You extort, you get a big price for the contract. You do a little bit of work. The guys, hopefully the city says, when are you coming back? Well, pay us a little bit more. And the prices goes up and up and up, but the project never gets finished. So you've got that kind of venal corruption almost.
You know, Mike, I think a lot of people are going, ooh, lots of doom and gloom in the room today. But I do think that this is an important lens, especially going into a series of Democracy Unplugged, where we're looking at the GNU and we're looking at a 100 days in. What have you done? What are your plans? What does the next 5 years look like? I think this is a fantastic lens through which to consider all of the things that we must now consider as we start to interrogate the ministers that are now in place. It's not enough to be a minister that's all over social media, all over the place, walking and losing weight, and you know.
Let's talk about the potential good news.
Yeah,
because there is potential good news, and that is that the voters indicated this year that they were sick of it. Mm. If that trend continues and goes into 2026, political parties are going to hopefully get a wake-up call that either that the thing that's starting to matter is not your political games, a la what's just happened in Tshwane. What's starting to matter is whether you deliver or not, or else citizens are going to eject you, right? And that already does a lot of stuff, right? And we've just got to do more of that. And pretty soon you have people starting to behave properly because, you know, they start losing their jobs. They start going to jail because a lot of pressure is now being put to bear on the prosecuting authorities. And suddenly it doesn't take a lot to fix up a place like this. It just takes people doing what they're paid to do. Mm. And we would fix this place up in no time. Mm.
Do you think they're scared? Do you think they're scared now that they've seen that people, I mean, few people showed up to vote as it is, right? So our voter turnout, low. But even of those that turned up, they very emphatically said, we're tired of your bullshit. Do you think that the politicians are scared?
I think they're scared, but they're not scared enough. And the GNU, sadly, one of the failings of the GNU is that to many of the senior people, especially in the ANC, it doesn't feel like they lost anything.
It was a backdoor.
So it's a backdoor deal, and it's still the same. You're still living in the same house, even though somebody else bought half of it. So they haven't been made to feel scared enough yet, right? But as things go along and as we get deeper into this, people will hopefully get scared enough. But, yeah, I think we've got to make sure that programs like this, like what we do on State of the Nation, keeps on highlighting the problems and highlighting solutions.
Because it blows my mind every time how complicit everybody else has been in kind of the rah-rah of the nonsense, right? So I see people talking about the GNU-GNUing. I see people talking about the GNU delivering. I see people talking about how much better everything is. And I'm not sure they talk about it on...
I'm going to say radio. One thing that is positive about the GNU, and that is that if for nothing else, it started to make us feel like maybe things are a little better, and that's no small feat.
Mm.
That's a start. Mm. That's at least a start. But the next part is to say, okay, fine, I feel a little bit better. The rand's a little bit stronger. Petrol price is a little bit lower.
But the lights are on.
The lights are on, but now I want more. I don't want potholes. I don't want this. I don't want that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's my positive takeaway.
Mm. Sure. We didn't even get to talk about, we're like 30 days away from, we're less than 30 days from the American, like one of the biggest election points this year, in a year of elections, is coming up. And we didn't even get to talk about that. Mm. Any words?
Pretty.
I know it's 8 o'clock, but we can have like 5 minutes, ne?
Can we have five minutes? I'd like to hear what Mike has to say. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, I think that America's has got serious problems. I think that I'm not a fan of a two-party system. And to me, the most undemocratic thing you have in the world, somebody is a member of a political party. What are you saying, that I'm going to vote for this party the rest of my life? It's the craziest thing, right? Surely you lend your vote to a party because you like the candidates or you like their policies. But to say I'm a member regardless of what they say is ridiculous, right? Whichever party you're talking about. But in America, they're sitting with Hobson's choice. It's a horrible situation in America, in that they've been
Hobson's
choice. Yeah, you know, where there's just no good result. Yeah, right. Because there is no good result. I think these post-truth populists like Donald Trump, Jacob Zuma, these people that invent the truth as they're going. I think it's very dangerous. I think he's not. For those guys, I know there'll be a lot of hate mail, but the point is that he's not the Donald Trump of 2016. He's now an old, nasty man. He was a younger, nasty man then. Kamala Harris.
Let me just ask you, because I think this requires a little bit more delving a bit deeper than whether he's a nasty person or not. I mean, I would proffer that Hillary Clinton is a much nastier person in her real life than Donald Trump has ever been. Just look at how their families behave around them. And it's fine for people to throw this invective around, but why do you think he would be a disaster for America as opposed to Kamala Harris, who's been parachuted in at the last minute, who has been a part of this administration for the longest time, but now disavows everything that happened in that administration? How could he possibly be worse than her?
That's an almost impossible question. They're both such flawed candidates that it's hard.
Compared to what?
Gareth, we've got to be careful, and even in South Africa, we've got to be careful, and to go back to the South African situation, that we look for the savior that's from outside of the system.
I'm saying compared to what?
Okay, compared to a politician that gets out there that does just focuses on running the country better.
Mm.
That's becoming short supply. I don't think there are one, because I think at what's happened in America, we've got our own taste of it here, is that the politics have been pushed to the extremes, to the poles. If you're on the left, you've got to be as far left as possible. If you're on the right, you've got to be as far right as possible.
Agreed.
And that is, to me, very bad, you know, in democracies generally. It's happened many times, but eventually it'll come back more to a centrist view. And then you'll end up with a country that is governed better. For example, you know, we saw America doing really well under, you know, people like Reagan, like Clinton back then, where they were more, if you look at their policies, more centrist than left or right. You know, the one had a touch more social welfare than the other one. The other one a little slight bit more business friendly. Now you've got the extreme. You've got Trump wanting to give tax cuts to the rich. You've got Kamala Harris wanting to give more welfare. It's madness on both sides. And, you know, I don't see a good outcome there. I am very, very concerned. More, if I have to give the edge, what keeps me up a little bit more at night is the dalliance with the strong man that Trump does. I'm not a fan of that because, you know, this is a cycle I lived through. And, you know, if you go back to the Cold War, your strong man, strong man there, it doesn't end well. You know,
Cold War ended beautifully. What are you talking about? It ended with Reagan having a decisive victory over the Soviet Union. The war came down.
It took 40 years, Gareth. What I'm saying is it took 40 years of a considerably smaller global economy.
I'm just saying it was your words. You said it doesn't end well, and I'm telling you it does sometimes. I've given you an example from your own reason
why that you're going to go through a long period of pain before it ends well. Because, you know, do we really need – just think about how counterproductive military spending is. You know, we're going to spend money on making things that blow up and kill people instead of schools and things like that.
Speaking of, speaking of things that blow up and kill people and the Cold War, a lot of talk now with huge escalations in the Middle East and actually comparing it to what the world looked like pre-World War One and again pre-World War II, where there's so much tension and so much intractability and hard lines. Do you think we're at the brink of that? And also a need for military spending in America, who are the biggest military power, and a need to flex what they say they have in Iran. Do you think we are really on the brink of this global catastrophe and a blow up? Or even, is it necessary? Is it time that we had this thing, fight it out? And I are from the South. Sometimes you have to get into a slugfest.
Right.
Sometimes you have to get into a slugfest so that you can dispel the tension.
On this score, oddly enough, I'm quite optimistic.
Mm.
And I'll tell you where my optimism comes from. Is that I think that humanity very seldom goes backwards,
mm-hmm.
right? And I'm saying that that what I'm seeing is these sort of strong men are usually, you know, short man syndrome, trying to show how powerful they are. It's almost the last gasp of authoritarianism for now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Putin, Xi, Iran, etc. All these people behaving badly. To try and convince their people that they shouldn't kick them out, because at the end of the day, people want their freedoms. We all want our freedoms. Everybody does. And nobody wants their freedom more than people who are denied freedoms. So in Iran, why is this suddenly happening? Because remember, about a year ago, all of those riots,
2 years ago.
All those, the uprising, women wanting rights, women not wanting to wear the hijab, etc. What's the answer to that? Start a war with Israel.
Respectfully, I have to disagree. I mean, I think that the countries that are going through the biggest existential crisis at the moment are not countries being run by strong men. I mean, Russia, whether the average Russian likes it or not, is firm of purpose. You could say the same about China. You could say the same about Modi in India. You could say the same about the Iranian government, certainly not the people. But the real existential crisis is happening in places like Europe and Canada and the United States of America. Countries which have been trying to steer themselves as far away as possible from the idea of authoritarianism, and yet have created in their, and because you look at the kinds of powers that have been voted to the American president in the last 60, 70, 80 years since World War II. I think that it's worth people reading about Calvin Coolidge, for example, a man who basically was as vacant as Joe Biden is now. He had so little to do with the running of the country on a daily basis. He was president, cut a couple of ribbons, entertained some diplomats, didn't do anything. The American president can now assign, as Joe Biden ostensibly has, even though we know he's a vegetable. Kamala Harris has sent, $160 billion to Lebanon on the kind of stroke of a pen. This is not democracy, liberal democracy. This is authoritarianism. It's just cloaked in all of these other offices that make it seem that it's more palatable to people. So I don't know that this strongman argument isn't already gone too far. And by the way, I mean, I kind of agree more with Mike than I do with you, Pumi. We're not on the brink of World War III. The world is still more peaceful now than it has ever been at any other stage, certainly in my lifetime.
We have more armed conflicts today than we had in the time when, what's his name, the Ghanaian, was the head of the UN. We have more armed conflicts all over the world today.
Can you name more than three?
Uganda, Congo, Sudan, Israel. Four.
I don't think that that's right. I don't think that that's right. Certainly, the idea.
This is a UN report. This is not me making it up. It's a UN report. More armed conflicts today.
what's going on in Uganda at the moment is akin to an internal civil war more than it is an external world-involving conflict. There are only two major conflicts in the world right now, which everybody is paying attention to. Only two. And yes, there are nuclear capabilities involved here, which makes everybody a bit nervous. But I don't think anyone is on a path
that the world is paying attention to them doesn't mean that the others do not exist.
But we're certainly not on a path to nuclear.
The fact that the world is paying attention to them does not mean that the others are less important. You have more people dying in the Tigray-Ethiopian conflict than you've had in the Middle East. No one's talking about that. No one's talking about that. In Sudan, you have more people dying in those conflicts. The UN has left Sudan.
The UN has left the planet. Excuse me.
Look, there's a whole other, and I am not a fan of Guterres in any way. But what I'm saying, is that is it not time that we actually had the blow up that is needed in the Middle East to let the tension, because the tension in the Middle East has come to a place where it is intractable on both sides.
And that's for you. How's this any different? You know what changed things? Someone wins. What happened to the old idea that when you go to war, someone has to win? That is how you end a war. Nobody seems to understand that that is the only way to end this. Someone has to win.
But you and I agree then. Let them slug it out and someone has to win. That's what I'm saying.
Well, we've kept Mike longer than we should have.
Thank you, Mike.
Mike, thank you so much. And you can find Mike on his State of the Nation show. And Mike Sham, it's a great pleasure to have you on our show today. Thank you very much. I'm sorry it only got heated towards the end. I'd like to
write up. No, this is a great show. This was a fantastic show. Thank you for all of your insights.
Thank you for having me.
It's a fantastic way to end today's show. And I'm excited to see next week. Don't forget, Gareth, do your announcement again. Live read time. One last time. Yes, about.
Absolutely. So two quick things. First of all, there is a new Democracy Unplugged live studio audience event, which is happening next Wednesday, the 16th of October, 5:30 p.m. with the founder co-host of the Burning Platform, Justice Malala. He will be here with a panel of prominent political leaders to discuss 100 days of the GNU. You can get your tickets at contact@podcastparty.co.za. So email contact@podcastparty.co.za.